Because adversity is often the breeding ground for development. Dive into neurointerventional stories, the uncensored interviews. Our guests, all leaders in the field of neurointervention, share the difficulties they face, the complications they have had to manage, and speak without filters on little discussed, sometimes controversial, or simply taboo subjects. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Suchichantararat, and today I am with Dr. Italo Linfante for this new episode of INR Stories. Dr. Linfante, how are you today?
Hi, great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you briefly introduce yourself in a few words, your training, and how did you get here?
I am currently Director of Interventional Neuroradiology at Miami Neuroscience Institute and part of Florida International University Medical School, where I'm also Professor of Neuroscience and Radiology.
In looking at your CV, actually, I saw that you have fellowships in interventional, well, and as well as cerebrovascular at Beth Israel. So you've had training from multiple institutions. Can you comment on kind of your path in the beginning?
So I'm a neurologist by training, and I did a fellowship in Neuro ICU, Beth Israel Deaconess, and it was many years ago, early in the 16th century. And at that time, when I was at Beth Israel Deaconess, I saw the first patients being treated by endovascular embolization before aneurysms. Being in the ICU, we see these patients are were clipped and they, of course, have problems. And then since until this, it was pretty amazing. So I decided to shift. So I was already attending. So I decided to start this career of started to learn endovascular, one of the first neurologists doing endovascular. So it was challenging because at that time only radiologists were doing endovascular. Right. And so all my friends at Beth Israel Deaconess says, you know, you're crazy. Where are you? You're leaving an attending position. I was having some funding grants to do research in neuro ICU and stroke to become a fellow again. So I started a fellowship at BI Deaconess with Dr. Hirsch, who then moved to NGH. Then I met A.J. Waklu, who was at the time was University of Miami. So I did half of my fellowship at Beth Israel Deaconess, and then A.J. Waklu took me to the University of Miami because he was there. And A.J. Waklu is a phenomenal. I was really talking about mentorship. Not only is a phenomenal operator, but he's an inventor and an entrepreneur, doing a tremendous amount of research. He's basically the person who invented flow diversion, which is... At this meeting now, we are, 23 years later, them putting flow diverters in the middle sleep artery for aneurysm. I mean, if that works, we don't need anything else pretty much. So he's really a person who changed this field forever. So it was very exciting working with him. We're very, very busy doing a lot of cases at University of Miami. And actually, I did so many cases that he says, you know, you don't need to do any more training. It's only a year and a half. And then I started doing endovascular, you know, as an attending. And then with Raul Noguera, Tudor Jovin, and Sam Zaidat, then and a friend of mine says, oh, these are the three guys who are crazy like you were doing endovascular. And so I met these three crazy guys, and they were these guys
very
here.
Powerful guys.
No, but at the time, I was just doing their fellowship. Yeah. So it's funny to meet them. And I always say the same story that I say, no, how are you doing? This is so fun. We do gnostic angio. We're calling aneurysm. It's amazing. And especially do fantastic. And I say, yeah, it's amazing for us, but we're getting trained. But do you think you're going to have a job afterwards? Because we're neurologists. And so there we go. Then we started a society for neurologists to do endovascular, which is now SVIN, Cerebrovascular Interventional Neurology, for what I was a president for 2 years. And I think neurologists is the fastest group of physicians doing endovascular. And thank God there's neurologists, because there's no way that the interventional radiologists could have covered all the cases they were doing now. Because at that time, there was mostly aneurysms. You know, there were some AVMs, carotid stenting. But then stroke was just at the beginning. But now with stroke being whatever it is, I think, my personal opinion, humble opinion, we're just starting. So interventional neuro is going to explode in the next 10 years. So not only aneurysm, for instance, I'm completely shocked of embolizing the middle meningeal artery and see a subdural hematoma disappear. That's fascinating. I mean, I never thought I would see this in my own. We're doing probably as many middle meningeal artery embolization as aneurysms. And I have probably 95% resolution of the subdural hematoma, which is unbelievable. So we're doing that. So that's going to be well established, maybe even before borehole for a cure. And we'll see what happens. But this is going to, and the number of cases, I just gave a talk, a review, because of the aging of the population, this is a pathology, is going to be a huge field. Stroke is tremendous. Mm-hmm. We turned a disease, which is an MC occlusion, as an 85% death to disability into maybe like 15% death to disability, 20%. So that's going to keep expanding as well. I'm working on a neuroprotective medication. There's a gap in thrombectomy. We probably recanalize. Looking at our data, we have 99% TK2B or 3 at Baptist Hospital, which is a high-volume center. But then we don't have 90% good outcomes. You have maybe like, 60% good outcomes. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm working on a molecule, which is a very original molecule. It's an oxygen carrier. It's a molecule that carries oxygen, delays collateral circulation. So we're going to go into phase 3 trial to see if that's... that can expand the treatment for stroke. Yeah. So I feel it's going to expand. I think we're going to have the problem of having after-operators.
We're going to have a lot more need for all the interventionalists coming out. That's for sure. And there's no doubt that from the neurology pathway, certainly you guys are all the giants that have moved the field of thrombectomy forward, such that now it's become a standard of care. It's clear that there's a huge contribution there.
And the other point that you're making is that we are changed. At the beginning, it was mostly like case research in our field. It was case series, device development, new device. But now we're in the era of clinical trials. So, I mean, we are really at the level of science in our field has grown tremendously. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy in the United States, thanks to the work of many brilliant people, we have 3 specialties that can do this. And thank God we have that, because otherwise there would be no way that we can cover all the tremendous 4 operators that we have in this field. I think the rest of the world is going to follow, because in the rest of the world is the same problem. Like in Italy, I'm Italian. In Italy, there's not enough operators. I mean, in England, there's not enough operators. I mean, we're talking about it. Big country. Can you imagine other in developing world?
Yeah. So the theme of the podcast is INR Story, the uncensored interviews. We are kind of focusing on the difficulties, whether it be personal or professional, as well as any kind of complications that the leaders in the field have had to manage. I think actually, now that you mention, the need for operators, right, given the expanding indications and the fast-growing nature of our field, what do you think is the solution to this? Do we just not recruit enough? Do we not produce enough to the places that need some? Or what do you think is a problem?
And we're talking about United States or worldwide?
Anywhere, worldwide.
So really. In the United States, I think we found a solution. I think having 3 specialties that can learn these techniques and be trained in these techniques and have equal possibilities job-wise, I think it is the solution already. The rest of the world, I travel a lot to South America, living in Miami. Sometimes I help my friends in Latin America. They don't have some places don't have the structure, because another problem with our field is very technologically driven. Mm-hmm. So you need to have a good angio suite, you need to get good materials. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem for countries which are having difficulties maintaining a good healthcare system. So I think in this part of the world, I'm not sure what the solution is. I mean, I think hopefully they will open up to neurologists to do this, but I think they have their main problem is technology and how they're going to pay for all these materials. We discuss also at the industry level, and they do that. I mean, they're cutting down their prices for their devices in Latin America, for instance, in Southeast Asia. We're trying to find a solution so we can help. I mean, basically, the bottom line, we want to help everybody. I mean, someone who has a stroke, either if they are in Argentina or in Venezuela or in Cuba or in, Indonesia, they should be able to go to an angio suite and solve their problem. It doesn't like exactly like we do in Boston or in Miami or in New York, right? It should be like that. It's a big challenge. So talking about challenges, it's a big challenge to bring this type of technology to save people's life everywhere in the world.
So we're going to just shift gear a little bit, and we'll talk about what would you say is the biggest professional difficulties you've had to overcome during your career?
Well, my story is a little complicated because I'm Italian. So I'm not supposed to be in this country. in the United States. We're in France. But I was supposed to be in the United States. So I went there by kind of chance, maybe luck, I'm not sure. But it is challenging for, and many physicians, I don't know what your story is, come from the United States, from different part of the world, is difficult because you leave your home country, leave your family, you leave your friends. And why do we do that? We do that to be better doctors, right? That's why we did that. You know, you realize that the training in the United States is pretty phenomenal. But it's, of course, it's very difficult. You go through the assembly, you have to go through the immigration system, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very tough. And our job is demanding. I mean, I do both clinical practice and also do research. So the family life really suffers from that. It's difficult to find a balance.
In your opinion, do you think that we should make research mandatory in the field?
I think research is more of a passion. Mm-hmm. I think as part of the training, I think you have to do it. Mm-hmm. Because doing research opens up your mind in understanding what's going on doing research, how to interpret data. So I think it's important as part of the training. In our fellowship training, we do that. Mm-hmm. We just do clinical, but also do research. So I agree with you with that. Right. But then it's up to you. I mean, if you have the region is one of the things you do for passion. Mm-hmm. So you know you have passion about taking care of patients because you're a physician, but to spend time in a lab or spend time analyzing data, that's something that some people have it as a passion, some people don't have it. So I think it's difficult to mandate that, but I think it's important. And then, of course, you come to the meetings and people update you to what's going on.
Right. So we ask the same four questions that we ask everybody. So the first is that if you had to take a journey through time, maybe 10, 15 years ago, what do you think you would have done differently? Was there anything that you would change?
Maybe pushing the hospital to give us more infrastructure, training more people. Family life, it's a problem. But then on the other hand, what we do, it's so important. I'm a very compulsive person. So in order to be able to do what we do every day with minimal, pretty much no complication. I mean, I don't remember last time I had a complication for an ruptured aneurysm. And I've done probably over 1,000 aneurysms. But the reason why we do that, because we train so hard. Mm-hmm. We are so compulsive. We do so many cases day and night that you are, at the end, you are almost perfect, that you really, you can achieve your goal in treating what you're supposed to treat, and if something goes wrong, you know how to fix it. Mm-hmm. So that requires a tremendous amount of sacrifice, personal sacrifice and family sacrifice.
And if we fast forward 15 to 20 years, how do you imagine this field will evolve?
Well, hopefully it's not artificial intelligence. I'm a little bit worried about that, to be honest.
Yeah. Okay, would you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very powerful tool that, like every powerful tool, in the right hands can bring tremendous amount of benefit to human society. Mm-hmm. But in the wrong hands can do tremendous harm. Mm-hmm. I'm very worried about that, to be honest. So we'll see what the next 10, 15 years. I mean, it's not a problem for me, it's a problem for all the people who rule this world. For us, I mean, coming to this meeting, I see all the newer generations, people like you, they're enthusiastic, they're bright, they do research, they're excellent, they're phenomenal. My fellows, I mean, big reward of my job is the fellowship program. We train fellows every 2 years. Mm-hmm. We become lifetime friends, of course, because it's such a amazing partnership. Mm-hmm. They're phenomenal. So I think that younger generations are really, really, really smart. So it's very good. This field is going to explode. Hopefully we can treat cancer, we can treat stroke better and everything else. So I think it's going to be, the future is going to be very bright, except for AI.
Well, I think it's just, one of those things. It's the theme of our field seems to be that we are growing at the rate that there's no infrastructure to support, meaning that, we're running out of operators, we're running out of a way to put AI in a box that regulates it so that it's not outgrowing what we're able to.
I think in the States it's less. The States is less. Maybe Europe is less. But if you go, I know where you're coming from, your stories. I went to South America to help my friends doing cases. I mean, I've done aneurysm on a single plane, on a C-arm. Mm-hmm. On a single plane, you can barely see anything. It really breaks your heart. Yeah. Or some patients cannot be treated because there's not enough operators that can even do whatever they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So lots of people still die from something that in the United States or Europe or in France, they don't. Mm-hmm. So that's really heartbreaking. So I think that's more than United States. I think United States is good because it's a is kind of a gym for us to know exactly what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have two more questions. We will now turn our attention to the training aspect, which you kind of alluded to. What do you think we don't do enough for the trainees coming out today?
So I think we are not well standardized yet. Because the problem is that someone goes to a training program where they don't have a lot of cases load, or they're not well prepared. So they come out of their training, they're not well prepared to, you know, treat a ruptured 3 millimeter basal tip aneurysm or a complex AVM. So that's a little bit, we need to put some more effort to that. And there's an effort at different societies are working on it, on a certification process. They need to have a certain number of cases, a certain number of hours, a certain number of research, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that this comes to fruition, which is also a problem. It's a new specialty, so understand that too. Mm-hmm. We're kind of, you know, making the car as we go, so to speak. So that's a little bit of a challenge. But on the other hand, it's extremely rewarding, like we said before. Mm-hmm. But it's a challenge we're going to have. You know, we're standardizing the training. So having a certification process that certifies centers who can provide the best training mm-hmm. for an applicant, for someone who wants to pursue this field.
Yeah. I think another kind of challenge too that I see is that you were mentioning the matching process. There's such a wide variety of timeline. Like for me, because I'm a neurosurgery trained, I have to decide by fourth year of my residency, which is 7 years. But for someone who's a neurologist or radiologist whose residency is shorter, you are asking someone to decide on their life as a first year in residency because the fellowship process starts so early and it fills up so early.
Yeah, and I think is the way you solve it is to have people rotate. What we do, for instance, in neurology, I'm sure you do in neurosurgery, you rotate through all the different, so you do some spine, some skull base, tumors. Neurologists go to EMG, they go to ICU, they go to stroke and see what fits your needs. And probably it's done in neurosurgery and it's done in radiology, but in neurology, I would like to see the neurology training program offering, let's say, a month elective in endovascular, and see if the candidate's like, because it's the only way the candidate can figure it out, mm-hmm. if that's whatever they want to do.
We have a question on Twitter, actually, from one of the trainees. He asks a really good question that, you know, in order to be a well-rounded interventionalist today, how do you capitalize on all of the three specialties and what they have to offer when you come from a single path? I mean, perhaps that would be one of the things is that we send people to do elective in other specialties and make that part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
Right.
No, absolutely. And in our fellowship program, the three attendings, I'm a neurologist by training, Dr. DeBoos is a radiologist, and Dr. Robert Wicks is a neurosurgeon. So mm-hmm. I think you can see all aspects mm-hmm. and you learn from each other. Mm-hmm. So from neurological, you learn more the clinical aspect, the ICU management, the radiologist, you learn the imaging part in the very detail, and neurosurgeon, they don't learn the neurosurgical mm-hmm. component of it. Mm-hmm. So I think having a fellowship program which is well-rounded with attendees from different specialties, I think it'll make a huge difference too.
Yeah, and having people who are cross-trained like yourself, I think that's also a very important part of it, because yes. Everyone is cross-training everybody in this field now. And then the last question, we are going to end on a more positive note. So we're going to talk about whether you have one thing, whether it be initiative, any person or any technological advancement in the recent months or years that you think have been the highlight of our field.
Oh, there's so many.
Neuroprotection, perhaps?
Yeah, neuroprotection is definitely one. And I think it's going to bring to some great advancements. OCT that was presented today mm-hmm. is pretty very exciting. Mm-hmm. The card that you can bend to select different ways. Intrasaccular device, it's amazing. And then there's interface between computer and brain is going to be very interesting mm-hmm. with a stent rod, this device, a place interface. They do something for the spinal cord. There was just a paper published in Nature which implanted a microchip that can translate some of the brain signal to the spinal cord to make someone walk. So it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Interaction between computer and brain interface. Mm-hmm. I think it's something we're going to see in the field is developing. So now always very exciting stuff. And then, like I said, neuro-oncologists, I think it's going to be a great positive development in our field.
Thank you so much, Dr. Linfante, for
You're
your time
very
today.
Thank you.